Chapter 3. First Steps. Sandrine. The magnitude of the job we had before us was dizzying. 50,000 possible leads spread across the world. At least I felt dizzied by it. The only thing to do, I knew, was to maintain composure and proceed methodically. One step at a time. The first step was not difficult to identify. We had to begin the process of assessing the list. We trusted the source, but mere trust was a shaky foundation on which to build a major investigation. We would never publish a story that relied only on the data on the list. We had to authenticate the data independent of the source. And we had to understand and interpret the meaning of that enormous list of mobile phone numbers that had been handed over to us. Did an appearance on the list represent an actual spyware infection, or a targeting, or simply a selection for targeting? And was that spyware in question NSO's Pegasus system? We would have to find out, which would take time. We had to put names to as many of the tens of thousands of phone numbers on the list as possible. And we had to convince a handful of those people to allow us to check their mobile devices for any evidence of infection with Pegasus malware. We had one small advantage at the start, which was our work on the cartel project. Mexican entities, government, and perhaps otherwise, were reported to have been the most active end users of NSO spyware, and the list bore out this allegation. More than 15,000 of the data points represented targets selected by somebody in Mexico. One of the first things we had done on the cartel project was to gather a roster of every journalist who had been killed in Mexico in recent years. So we made a new subset. Every Mexican journalist murdered after 2016, the earliest timestamps in the leaked list. Put those names up on a board and tasked Paloma and an intern with the job of finding the cell phone numbers each of those victims was using at the time of his or her death. Maybe some would match the new list. Maybe a few had even left behind phones we could run through a forensics analysis. The rest of the team helped out by gathering Mexican phone books that would be useful in trying to match as many of the numbers on the list as we could. But that was only the first of many, many steps, and my job was to conceive the first step, the last step, and every one in between required to get us to final publication. It was like reckoning how to lay down one by one a series of flat stones that allowed us to cross a wide body of water, of unknown depths and dangers, with rapids we couldn't yet see, and likely some very angry crocodiles guarding the final shore, too. Along the way, we would have to maintain the absolute anonymity of our source, who could be in real danger, at risk of physical injury, or even death if unmasked. The added tension of designing a plan for this investigation was the plain fact that the project would be the safest and most secure if we simply kept it within our family circle at Forbidden Stories and Amnesty International's security lab. Every outside partner we brought into the project would increase the possibility that the investigation into Pegasus would be found out. Intelligence services from Saudi Arabia or Morocco, or the UAE or Israel, or from any of the dozens of countries who had a serious interest in keeping the spyware hidden, were almost certainly monitoring the digital landscape for breaches. One misstep from one partner could blow the cover for everyone. At the same time, because of the extraordinary amount of data, it was impractical, if not impossible, to do this investigation without very strong reporters and editors from many of those countries. Add to that, the mission of Forbidden Stories at its heart is collaborative journalism. We were just 3 years old, still in the process of growing a network of partners, and still working to earn their trust. The more partners we could bring on board, the better. So my task was to minimize that unavoidable tension, to put together what would likely be the biggest collaboration we had ever done, in the safest way possible. We needed to identify the media partners from across the world that we wanted to bring into the investigation, and determine exactly when to invite them in, to convince them to share all of their reporting with all of the partners. Not so easy among reporters normally driven by competition and exclusivity. To map out a plausible schedule for the project, to coordinate a final publication date, and convince the partners to stick to a predetermined order of stories as they broke. We would also have to institute safety protocols for communication among the partners. The good news was Claudio and Danica were more than capable of designing the safety protocols. And on the question of high stakes, high profile journalism in secrecy, we had a really good person to whom we could turn for advice. Maybe the best possible person. "We'd like to set up a call with you," Laurent wrote to Bastian Obermeier on a secure message app. "But it can't be on a cell phone. Do you have any kind of device without a SIM card?" Bastian wrote back immediately, "I do, because of John Doe." He seemed excited at the chance to put the device back in use. And what a device it was. The one Bastian and his colleague, Frederick Obermeier, had used to communicate with perhaps the most famous John Doe in the annals of journalism. This John Doe had pinged Bastian Obermeier out of the blue one evening back at the beginning of 2015. "Interested in data? I'm happy to share." That offer to an investigative reporter at the German newspaper Süddeutsche Zeitung mushroomed over the next year into the then biggest data leak in the history of journalism by far. A total of 2.6 terabytes with more than 11 million emails, texts, and corporate documents tied to a single but very, very productive law firm in Panama. The leak revealed the existence of more than 200,000 offshore companies birthed by that firm, Mossack Fonseca, for the benefit of world leaders, political figures, billionaires, drug lords, business executives, and art dealers, among others. The companies were incorporated in tax-friendly and financial transparency inimical places like Panama, the British Virgin Islands, the Bahamas, Samoa, Hong Kong, and the states of Delaware, Nevada, and Wyoming in the U.S. The true beauty of the offshore companies, as far as Mossack Fonseca clients were concerned, was that they shielded the actual owners from public view. This made these entities excellent vehicles for tax avoidance, tax evasion, money laundering, general criminal buccaneering, or in the case of folks like Equatorial Guinean Minister of Forestry and Agriculture, Teodorin Obiang, Azeri President Ilham Aliyev, and Russian President Vladimir Putin, plundering a nation's natural resources for fun and profit. Bastian and Frederick had at first been overwhelmed by this Himalayan-sized mountain of data to sort, with more coming in all the time. As their editor at Süddeutsche Zeitung pointed out at the start, no single news organization on earth had the resources in-house to do this investigation with the thoroughness required for maximum impact. So Bastian, Frederick, and their editor made a really consequential decision. They decided to share the massive leak with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, ICIJ, which helped to turn the Panama Papers into the biggest act of collaborative journalism in history. When the Panama Papers first broke in April 2016, after more than a year of investigation, it was the work product of 400-plus reporters at more than 100 discrete media organizations around the world. The story was front page news across Europe, Asia, Africa, and the Americas, in some of the most respected media outlets on the planet. Revelations of corruption torpedoed world leaders and business executives, and eventually helped to expose the corruption of the one-time campaign chairman of a winning U.S. presidential candidate. It also put tax evasion by the wealthy at the top of the agenda for a host of governments and international organizations, such as the G20. The former South African president called the Panama Papers a massive blow to financial secrecy. The investigation received multiple awards for investigative and explanatory journalism, including a Pulitzer Prize. The Panama Papers also made Bastian Obermeier, at 38, one of the most recognized and respected investigative reporters on the planet, as well as the face of collaborative journalism. So, who better to call for a chinwag about how to proceed on our own potentially enormous leak? It helped that Bastian and Laurent were friends. The two had spent the academic year of 2016-17 together at the Knight Wallace Fellowship Program at the University of Michigan. Laurent had arrived in Ann Arbor in the wake of a punishing 18 months, which included the Charlie Hebdo massacre, the arrest and imprisonment of Khadija Ismailova, a groundless but still threatening libel suit filed against him, and the coup de grace, a broken spine suffered in a car crash while on a reporting trip in Iraq. Laurent had decided to take a year away from the grind of investigative journalism, and the fellowship gave him the opportunity to hit pause long enough to try to get Forbidden Stories off the ground and funded. He figured Bastian, who had to stand as the most celebrated fellow in Knight Wallace history, had gone to Michigan mainly for rest and recuperation from his long year working on the Panama Papers. Laurent later told me that while he had been impatient to approach Bastian about his idea for Forbidden Stories, he was not without worry. If the face of collaborative journalism was cold to the idea, it would be devastating. Bastian was not only encouraging, he turned into the perfect sounding board and sparring partner for Laurent. Over coffee or beers, the hero of the Panama Papers brainstormed with Laurent about how to build a team, where to raise funds, how to make a pitch for money. Bastian also poked and prodded the weak points of Laurent's proposal. The most successful collaborations were international, right? But how do you convince people in the U.S. to be interested in a story in Cambodia or Sierra Leone or Morocco? Best of all, over time, Bastian became invested in the idea of Forbidden Stories, even devoted to it. He took Laurent to see potential donors, introduced him to key people at the ICIJ, and agreed to serve on the Forbidden Stories Board of Directors. When we reached Bastian on his SIM-free device and began to explain the outlines of the cyber surveillance leak to him, the mountain of inchoate data, tens of thousands of potential victims in dozens of countries, didn't cow him in the least. He was in yes mode right away and offered some really important tips from his experience on the Panama Papers. The first thing he did was to assure us that we were right in our instinct to make the protection of the source our paramount concern. He had never divulged to even one of the hundreds of reporting partners identifying characteristics about his John Doe, he explained to us, no matter how many times they asked. Anybody we let into our new collaboration, he told us, would have to trust our word that the source was solid. Bastian, who understood the pressure we were under better than anyone, never asked us the identity of the source. He seconded our plan to grow the project in ever-widening circles to ensure security and control. First, spend some time with our in-house team vetting the data. Then invite in a small set of 4 or 5 partners we could trust, but insist that there be only one reporter and one editor from each. Nobody else in their respective newsrooms could know in that initial phase, even as they helped us run down more potential victims. After we were confident the material was going to lead us to real stories of real import, we could widen out to a much larger cohort, one best positioned to run down the stories we wanted to focus on, to give them political context, and to elicit personal stories from the victims of Pegasus. Bastian also warned us never to say anything to the first circle that we weren't also ready to say to the wider circle. With our Forbidden Stories team at work already, and the advice and support from Bastian in the bank, I scheduled a second meeting in Berlin with Claudio, along with his boss at Amnesty International's security lab. This was still the very early stages of our partnership, and there were a lot of questions about security and logistics and division of responsibilities to work out between our two very different organizations. We were a small and very new entity. Amnesty International was a venerable institution with thousands of employees, offices in more than 70 countries, and political imperatives to consider. They had ultra-skilled tech geeks. We were tech novices. They were human rights defenders. We were journalists. The only thing we could do was start down the road together and see where it went. We felt ready to present our plan for executing our end of the difficult project and to hear the security labs. When I asked Bastian if he would be willing to travel from his home in Munich to Berlin in the coming weeks to join the meeting, he agreed. The trip to Berlin was a reminder that, especially in the age of COVID, the best laid plans were likely to require recalibration and improvisation. When the time came to travel, Bastian was grounded by a personal issue, so he asked to join our meetings with the Amnesty International team by secure app. There was much to discuss. We all understood that the data at this point was little more than a jumble of phone numbers and timestamps. And even after we put as many identities to those numbers as we could, we wouldn't have proved anything. Not even that the data touched on NSO and its Pegasus spyware system. As Bastian had pointed out, our conundrum was very different from the one he had faced with the Panama Papers. The difficulty there was in explaining very complicated and opaque financial shenanigans to a lay audience. But most of the subjects, the Panamanian law firm that structured the offshore companies, the strawman directors who signed the official documents, and the actual owners, were named in the data, blazoned across millions of emails and incorporation documents and the like. Our difficulty would be in finding the evidence of spyware attack in the phones, allowing us to write that the data actually represented people targeted by or infected with NSO's Pegasus. Marshaling that evidence depended largely on Claudio Guarnieri's professional expertise. Claudio had spent years chasing down NSO and other private for-profit purveyors of cyber surveillance systems. He and Danica were in the process of developing a forensic tool capable of capturing traces of Pegasus that NSO operators had left behind in the system files of infected mobile phones. Without Claudio and his tools, the list was just so much indecipherable digital hieroglyphics. We needed the security lab, but the security lab also needed us. It would be up to us to convince targets to allow Claudio and Danica to put their phones through invasive digital forensics analyses. But while the security lab could show readers how the Pegasus cyber surveillance system worked, it would be up to Forbidden Stories and its partners to determine why the end users chose their specific targets, and what were the consequences that befell those targets. It would also be up to Forbidden Stories and its partners to provide what Claudio and his team at the security lab really wanted, to make sure the product of all their hard work landed on the public doorstep with a thud that could not be ignored or swept away. They wanted to have impact, and they wanted to have impact in a way that helped human rights defenders fight back against the intimidation so many suffered in their home countries. One of Amnesty International's central missions was to protect the courageous souls who were trying to expose human rights violations and to hold people to account for those human rights violations. Claudio's boss at Amnesty Tech, Dana Ingleton, had recently said, "We want to make sure that we identify and prevent risk before it happens." Dana arrived with Claudio and Danica at a different Airbnb in Berlin in October 2020. Claudio was just the same, taciturn, to the point, without wasted word or motion. The, "We are sorry for the inconvenience, but this is a revolution" sticker was still affixed to his laptop. He wore the knit ski cap pulled tight across his skull. His t-shirt read, "Police the police." He did seem friendlier, more familiar, but still wary. As he later confided, he was at that moment thinking, "What are we getting ourselves into?" There was a lot of uncertainty. Partly, we didn't know just what the data meant. But I think we were also concerned that you're a journalist and might read too much into it and overhype it and say there's something in the data that isn't there. This was our first face-to-face meeting with Dana, but she made it plain right at the start that she knew that the only way we were going to get across the finish line on this project was together, arm in arm. Claudio and Danica were the maestros of forensics, but Dana was vested with decision-making at Amnesty Tech. She had the power to hit the go button. Her overriding concern and the first order of business was the safety of the source, from pillar to post. We agreed. I spent much of the first part of the meeting sketching out our plan of attack, which was basically what we had discussed with Bastian and a little added detail. We explained to Dana and Claudio the two circles of partners, a few colleagues from the media outlets we trusted most at the start, and then the addition of as many reporters as needed from all over the world to chase down the most promising leads. We explained that we needed to safely land our current project, the Cartel Project, before diving headlong into Pegasus. That meant we would inform the first circle of partners of the project after the first of the year, in January 2021, and maybe sit down as a group and start to shape the pieces of the investigation in early March. We wanted to do that in person in Paris. We would work with that small group for a few months, identify as many victims as we could, and deliver their phones for forensic analysis. When we felt confident that the findings truly did implicate NSO and its end-user clients in this massive campaign of cyberspying, and we had identified the stories we wanted to tell, we would widen the circle. From there, we expected, it would take 6 or 8 more weeks to get to publication. We understood those final months would be the most vulnerable for all of us: forbidden stories, our partners, the security lab, and especially the source. The longer the investigation took, the more partners added, and the more victims alerted, the greater were the chances of being found out, which meant we were worried about stretching the timeline to the breaking point. We told Dana and Claudio we hoped to publish in June 2021. Laurent and I were anxious to know about security protocols, which would be the responsibility of Claudio and his team. They would have to design a way for us to communicate with the security lab as well as with all our media partners. They would have to set up a secure website where an increasing number of partners could share their most recent reporting in real time. I learned some interesting lessons listening to Claudio and Danica talk online security. Less important than understanding when and where you were protected, I gathered, was understanding when and where you were vulnerable, which was pretty much everywhere in the digital universe. Here's how they put it. We operate on the assumption that any device can be hacked. And that's why, even though we check our phones regularly, we still turn our phones off and leave them in a different room when we're discussing sensitive topics. Or we leave the office and go for a walk. If I would have to worry about every specific type of attack, and whether or not I would find means to detect it or not detect it, it would be completely impossible for me. I would have to check that device and that device and this device, swipe the room with RF scanner and some other kind of equipment, and check every power socket. I would have to make sure that there were no antennas pointing towards the window. You know, it's just impossible. So what we need to start thinking is, what do I do to minimize these things on an operational level? And that's where the compartmentalization comes in. Like meeting in certain places and not others, you know? Or I know that my phone can be hacked, so either I don't have a phone or I don't use it for anything important. I don't have it with me at important times, or I make sure that my phone number is not known to anybody. My laptop has measures that I can afford in terms of mitigations and control and whatnot. But I don't use that laptop for personal things, and I don't bring it with me if I have to do meetings about Pegasus. If there are things that are sensitive that I don't want to leave exposed because I'm afraid of someone breaking into my house, then I make sure to take those things with me. These kinds of measures are the ones that matter. Ultimately, what really makes a difference is the operational security aspects rather than the digital one. That's what it boils down to. Bastian was able to join us on the secure app a few hours into the meeting in Berlin, and he was very reassuring to Dana. He had experience in large journalistic collaborations where secrecy was paramount, and he told her, in his usual direct and resolute manner, that there was no reason Laurent and I would ever need to share the source of the leak with any of the media partners. The ability to publish, after all, depended on the security lab's forensic tool digging out evidence of Pegasus infections in cell phones from the list. If the forensics were a success, the media partners would have what they needed to go to press. The source of the leak would be beside the point. If the forensics came up empty, there was no story. We also decided over the course of the 2 days of meetings that it would be best to break this story all at once. We had considered going to press over a number of weeks or even months in waves by geography. A package on the Gulf states, say, followed by one on India or Mexico or Morocco. But this felt too risky. The pressure from NSO's demonstrably aggressive legal team might shake some of our partners who were still working on their stories. So we decided the consortium would publish the initial stories on the same day across the world, and then roll out a series of reports over the next week or so. Our first day headlines, assuming we got the proof, would be in the sweet spot of this new partnership, the exact point where the missions of Forbidden Stories and Amnesty Tech intersected. The first articles would reveal the astonishing scale of the use of Pegasus to silence and intimidate journalists and human rights defenders all over the world. Even early in our meetings with Claudio and Dana, it seemed like we had agreed on a clear way forward. I had a pretty good feel for exactly what stepping stones we had to lay down, and in what order, to get us safely to publication. This was starting to feel doable. One unexpected problem did pop up on that trip to Berlin. Since we had last seen them, Claudio and Danica had been able to find the identities of the owners of a lot more of the phone numbers in the data. One good sign, Claudio mentioned, was that there were many matches with people identified as victims of Pegasus in a lawsuit filed by WhatsApp against NSO in the US in 2019. The security lab team had also turned up a lot of government officials. And while Claudio didn't have a great deal of interest in their presence, it was no big surprise that governments were spying on governments, and besides, national officials tended to have plenty of institutional protections in place, so they didn't need help from us. He did want us to have a look at some of the names he and Danica had discovered. Right away, Laurent and I started scanning through a section of the data that appeared to be targets selected by a client in Morocco. There were members of the French Parliament and ministers in the French government on the list. And then I saw one name that shortened my breath for just a second. "Laurent," I said, pointing to the screen. "Look at that name. Macron. Emmanuel Macron. The sitting president of the Republic of France. A head of state of one of the most respected democracies in Europe. Our president was on this list, a potential target. This was big, I thought. And it was also big trouble. Laurent saw it the same way. What struck him was the fearlessness, the sense of absolute impunity it required to believe you could spy on the president of France and get away with it. This was likely to be somebody at an organization that would do whatever it needed to keep the fact hidden. Macron was the name, Laurent would later tell me, that made me realize how truly dangerous it was to have access to this list. We were also both immediately aware of the complications that might arise if we discovered that a lot of other heads of state had been selected for targeting by clients of NSO. News that the personal cell phone of Emmanuel Macron or other prominent world leaders might be owned by a foreign intelligence service would likely overshadow the story we were really after, which was the threat to journalists and human rights defenders. Neither the French government nor any other was going to turn over the cell phone of any of their officials, let alone a president, to allow Claudio to run his forensics analysis. And what if there was evidence that opposition politicians from suspected NSO client states like India or Mexico or Ghana were in the data? Alerting those selected targets before the story broke risked blowing our cover before we were ready to publish. Politicians with an axe to grind were not likely to exercise much circumspection, even when asked. Then, too, would our partners from those countries be willing to embargo a red-hot local story until mass publication? The bottom line was this: Macron's private phone number in the data, and what that represented, was sure to entice more partners and to raise the visibility of the final publication. But it would have to be handled carefully. This new complication paled beside the most pressing one, the one that was largely out of our hands at Forbidden Stories: the ability of Claudio's forensic tool to produce the evidence we needed from the cell phones listed in the data. If the security lab was unable to turn up hard proof that these phones were infected with Pegasus and permit us to call out the malefactors, then NSO and their licensees, among them the most vicious regimes on Earth, would just go on operating their cyber surveillance system with the sort of abandon enjoyed by pirates and privateers. Their victims would continue to suffer the consequences. I lacked the training or the expertise to plumb the technical aspects of the security lab's digital forensic tool. But after spending many, many hours with Claudio, my confidence in him was growing. I knew for sure that overhyping on his part would not be a worry. He was calm, straightforward, and always thoughtful, occasionally maddeningly so. If I asked him a question, especially a technical question, there was invariably a pause before he answered. I could almost imagine the wheels spinning in his brain as he fashioned a response, which was always on point and precise. Claudio was also modest to a fault. The forensic tool he and Danica had engineered was not perfect, they kept telling us, but nothing was. The point was to keep improving it as the investigation developed. Their success depended on hard work and patience and diligence. It depended on being better at forensics than NSO was at anti-forensics, at covering their tracks. While in Berlin during the planning meetings, Laurent and I got a little demo of the tool Claudio and Danica were developing, and it wasn't an altogether pleasant experience for Laurent. He allowed his own cell phone to be subjected to the security lab's forensic analysis. The process didn't require much from him. He simply handed over the phone and watched as Claudio and Danica made a backup of the entirety of its contents and then ran it through the tool on a security lab laptop. The process was surprisingly labor-intensive. Danica would type in a command and watch as what looked like indecipherable code and data scrolled across and down the laptop's monitor. But he didn't just wait and watch. He'd click on a line of code and enter a new command, then another, then another. He typed a variety of commands as he went, and sometimes went back and rechecked an earlier line by typing new commands. Laurent said it was like watching a scene from a documentary on coders, but a very personal one, because this was his phone, and much of his work life and his private life was sitting on the security lab laptop. There was the fear of having been infected with spyware, but there was also the discomfort of giving over to a stranger access to thoughts and messages and photos meant to be private. As Danica continued to type commands, I could see Laurent edge in closer and closer until their shoulders were touching. I could tell he was excited and anxious and impatient. I had known him a long time. Laurent Richard and I had met 15 years earlier, in front of a coffee machine at the public television channel where we were both working, France 3. We were contemporaries in age, both in our late 20s, but very different in professional stature. I was a fairly anonymous young political reporter sent out to trawl public events and meetings for petites phrases, buzzy little quotes and anecdotes that were closer to gossip than news, material best used to poke fun at the powerful. Like candy that melts in your mouth, these tidbits were good for a sugar high, but unlikely to lead to any serious news. Laurent, meanwhile, had already made a name for himself as a very serious reporter on the channel's popular monthly investigative program, Pièce à Conviction. He was already doing life and death journalism. The day I met him, Laurent was in the process of reporting a story about the mysterious sinking of a fishing boat off the coast of Cornwall. He was trying to run down some leads that a British submarine in the area for international military exercises had accidentally pulled the boat under, leaving 5 men dead. This was, I would come to understand, the kind of investigation Laurent loves, both difficult and threatening to authority. The kind of investigation that can get you in trouble. They're a secretive lot. A lifeboat coxswain, who had never before seen a military submarine in the middle of a rescue operation, would later say. Over the next 10 years, I watched Laurent's career with growing interest and growing respect. He launched a new investigative program, The Infiltrators, whose reporters went undercover in really dangerous places. Laurent himself infiltrated the most horrific crime network I could imagine, a ring of pedophiles operating on the dark web. When the report aired in 2010, it made headlines all over France and led to the arrests of 22 people. I had lunch with Laurent a few days after the report aired, and he admitted to having been deeply shaken by the indescribably awful images and video he had to view in his reporting. Laurent was also pitching me on yet another television program he was trying to launch, which would become Cache Investigation. He asked me to come and work for him. I had tired of political journalism by then and moved on to doing investigations into private corporations for another channel. This was engaging and fulfilling work, with a steady paycheck. And as a young mother, I thought it unwise to leave for a program that did not yet exist and might fizzle before it launched. I turned him down, much to my regret. From the moment it hit the air in 2012, Cache Investigation was a fresh and bracing breeze. The series covered tax evasion, the power of corporate lobbyists, governmental conflicts of interest, greenwashing, and neuromarketing in offbeat and engaging ways that drew viewers in and helped them understand these complex political and economic subjects. The series had Laurent's fingerprints all over it. It made bold to dive into demanding and difficult subjects and did not shy from dangerous investigations. And unlike most everybody I know in television news, Laurent never talked about the ratings. The quality of the work itself was paramount. Cache Investigation quickly became the holy grail for any television journalist who wanted to do long and thorough investigative pieces, including me. By the time I called him up and talked my way onto the Cache Investigation team in 2015, Laurent had a foot out the door. He was already thinking about forbidden stories. The next thing was, as he described the mission of his new project to me, the most outlandish startup of the three he had pitched to me over the years. Farthest from the mainstream of journalism, maybe the most dangerous, and certainly the most difficult. I mean, he was going to convince a host of competitive and often parochial journalists to collaborate with one another to finish somebody else's original reporting. Reporting that had gotten the reporter killed, by the way. For the greater good? Experience, however, had taught me not to doubt Laurent Richard. It took me a while to free myself from Cache Investigation, but by the time I accepted Laurent's offer to take the job of managing editor at Forbidden Stories in 2019, I had no doubts about following him into this strange new world of collaborative journalism, aimed at giving voice back to reporters who had been silenced. A big part of the draw for me was my own personal history. I was born in Egypt in the late 1970s, daughter of a French father and an Egyptian mother. I grew up in Syria and Turkey and knew what it was to live in a country where freedom of expression was not a right, but a luxury. A potentially dangerous luxury for anyone who tried to exercise it. Schoolchildren in Western Europe and Canada and the U.S. might grow up reading 1984, but have little appreciation of the actual, real-world fact that billions of people are caught up in the repressive and sometimes violent daily nightmare that George Orwell describes in his novel. I knew it too well, that feeling of the oxygen of freedom being thinned to the point of vanishing. I remember too well how my parents sent me out of the house with explicit warnings. Do not speak of political issues outside the family circle. The consequences were just too dreadful to chance. I became a journalist because I wanted to be able to make sense of the world and to use my voice freely to explain it to others. So, being here in Berlin in 2020, trying to launch this new Forbidden Stories project with Laurent, felt a little like destiny for me. This was just where I wanted to be. Laurent's shoulder was still resting against Danica's, and his head had moved a little closer to the laptop. I could see his eyes scanning as new commands flashed across the screen. Until finally, after what seemed like an interminable interval, "You're clean. Everything is cool." Laurent's phone was in the clear, uninfected by Pegasus. "And I will now delete everything," Danica said. Then, aware of Laurent's distress at having the entire contents of his phone sitting on somebody else's laptop, Danica made sure Laurent could see it happen. "Here," he said. "Watch." The discomfort, and I felt it too when Danica checked my phone later, was a reminder that the process of digital forensic analysis was in and of itself invasive. Not that it was anything like being a victim of the NSO's signature spyware, but it did make us realize just how challenging it would be to ask somebody to submit the contents of their cell phone for a relative stranger to see. We knew we would have to carefully consider how best to approach the person we had chosen as our first test case, our reporting partner, Jorge Carrasco. We would have to convince him to let Claudio and Danica do the forensics, while holding back information that was not safe to divulge to him. The existence of the list, its link to NSO, and the possibility that his phone was infected by the most powerful cyber surveillance tool on the market, Pegasus. Paloma was headed to Mexico in a few weeks to tie up some reporting on the cartel project, and she was going to have to get Jorge in a room alone, no phones and no laptops, and convince him. The logistics of this sortie into Mexico were made more difficult by the pandemic. The vaccines were still in trials, a hoped-for panacea, but hardly a sure thing. The numbers of daily cases and hospitalizations were creating a harrowing upward slope. Travel restrictions made it unlikely that anyone from the security lab could be on site in Mexico City to test Jorge's phone. So Danica was going to try to tweak the security lab's forensic platform to allow analysis of the cell phone to be done remotely, with the help of somebody with little background in cyber research. The idea was that Paloma would make a backup of Jorge's iPhone and upload a digital file to Berlin, where Claudio and Danica could do their magic. A remote version of the forensic platform was ready in time for Claudio and Danica to give Paloma a very quick tutorial on what she needed to do for her part of the analysis. Claudio did not make any promises for success in Mexico. The best he could offer was this. Finding Pegasus using forensics wasn't as impossible as NSO claimed. So the great hope for exposing NSO was safely loaded onto Paloma's laptop on a late October day in 2020, when she left Paris for the long flight to Mexico City, right into the teeth of the NSO/Pegasus story.